Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the Ravens draft and review of each player picked. So if you missed part one, please go back and listen to that. Probably want to do that first. We just talked about the top three picks made on day one and two. Malachi Starks at pick number 27. Mike Green, the enormous value pick made at number 59. And Emory Jones, the pick at number 91, a guard tackle. And some of the things that I liked and didn't like about each of those three picks. I will say, I think they made one out of three really good value picks on the first 2 days. But the one value pick is so immense in terms of getting Mike Green, that you know, top 12 player in the draft, maybe at pick number 59, that you really... It's impossible to be unhappy with the combination of players they got. Malachi Starks, I think he'll be a good football player. I wasn't crazy about the choice relative to Evan Worry. You can listen to that and my reasoning on it. I'm absolutely at the opposite end of the spectrum from what it seems like every NFL pundit is. So if your natural inclination, I don't know why it wouldn't be, is to like the opinions of Kuiper or Jeremiah or Brugler or others. You know, they love Malachi Starks. I just don't love him at the same level, but I do think he's a good football player, and I hope he has a Hall of Fame career with the Ravens. I just would have rather had Evan Worry. And Emory Jones with the third pick. We talked a little bit about value. There is probably a slight reach, but a needs pick for the Ravens that addresses what they need in a big way for 2025. So I'm okay with that pick. I don't think it's a great pick, but it's okay. So we pick up the action in the fourth round now. And this was a really fun day, by the way, for the draft for us, because the Ravens had eight selections to make that day. If I wasn't so dog tired throughout this entire day, I got almost no sleep between night two and day three, which starts at noon, you know, so I'm up till 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, reviewing Emory Jones tape and more Mike Green video and getting excited about that. And then in the morning, and also putting together my list of additional guys who belong on what has to be a very deep spreadsheet in order to contain the guys who might be drafted on day three. Then the Ravens, of course, have eight selections, and they first came up towards the end of round four at pick number 129. And they took Teddy Buchanan of Cal. Now, an inside linebacker pick, did not really anticipate that an inside linebacker would be taken prior to round four. The fact that they used their first first round pick on it was even a little surprising, because the Ravens had not yet gotten any taste of the defensive line talent that was available in the draft. And that was, you know, it's an area of need for the Ravens. So it's also an area where there's a lot of depth, and the Ravens had some good chances to get higher quality players. And Teddy Buchanan, they picked at number 129. Now, my initial reaction to this was I really didn't like the pick, specifically for going against the high value need at the defensive interior relative to a lower value player at inside linebacker. Just the leverage on that position is not as high. You could do more things to platoon multiple players and get similar or even better results at that position, particularly on the weak side linebacker. But the Ravens did have a very identifiable need, not as much to replace the Will directly as to have a two-down thumper that could play either Will or Mike and replace Roquan if hurt, and also play Will linebacker along with a dime safety platoon would have been the way I'd look at that position. So I think they addressed that very, very directly with Buchanan, who's I am much more impressed as a football player with him after watching more tape overnight and seeing who he is. Kind of reminds you of Troy Polamalu with the long hair. He's 6'2", 233, 31 3/8 inch arms, runs a 4.60, which is plenty fast for an inside linebacker to deal with some of the mobile quarterbacks today. You don't have to be a 4.48 guy or a 4.52 guy or anything like that. Don't have an age on Teddy Buchanan, but he played 4 years at UC Davis before he played his final year at Cal. So he'll be either 23 or 24 in 2025. It still amazes me how effectively agents and players whitewash their ages from anywhere on the internet, and they make it so it's not possible to find. And obviously the athletic departments are part of this as well. They don't list birth dates for players, probably because they want to get their guys drafted higher and have that to show to potential new recruits. So everybody is complicit in this hide their age scheme that they have. It reminds me a little bit about of Dominican baseball players in the 1980s and how Epi Guerrero, who was a very big scout down there, was having everybody lie about their age. And so you had all these players claiming to be 19 years old. Junior Felix might have been the most extreme case of that, where he was either 4 or 6 years older than he was claiming to be. And they since, now that a lot of teams have much more of a Dominican presence, the game's been more Latinized in terms of where players come from, they're much more careful about getting correct age information from players down there. But anyway, what happens now, it's a little bit more of a minor thing that relates to the draft, is that you don't get a good birthday on players when you're looking for it during the scouting process. So back to Buchanan. Athleticism is a plus across the board. He tested in everything. Very good sign. You want the guys who want to test, even at some things that they're not going to be all that great at. He only had this one season in a former Power 5 conference. Of course, the Pac-12, Pac-whatever they were effectively absorbed into the Mountain West. So that's the group of players that a lot of those were playing with. Certainly the Cal were playing against with their opponents, with Oregon and USC, UCLA, you know, changing conferences. He had 7.2 yards per target in 2024. Career is only 6.2, a 79 opposition passer rating in 24, which is plenty good, but 53.8 career. So he has some coverage chops. Love to see that in a three-down linebacker or even a two-down linebacker. If he's just going to be there as a guy who can stuff the run, I still want a guy who can cover on those downs. So that's a positive thing. He had 48 stops and 10 missed tackles, 4.8-1. His career ratio is 5.9-1, with a career missed tackle rate of just 7%, which is outstanding. So you're getting a good tackler, and they're getting a guy with some coverage chops. I'll add a third thing. In 278 NCAA inside linebackers who rushed the quarterback at least 50 times. It's a pretty low standard. Gets you maybe into some trouble with sample size, but he had an 8.7 pass rush productivity, which was in the 44th percentile of that group for inside linebackers. But he had a very fine finish rate of 46.2%. So hopefully this is a guy, the pressure rate is more important. You'd wish it were a little higher, but he's very impressive about closing the deal once he gets home. And that missed tackle rate obviously is a positive for getting the quarterback on the ground. And I mentioned that this with Mike Green earlier, but that finish rate is quarterback hits plus sacks over total pressure events as defined by PFF. So I'm using the best proxy I have available to me in terms of that. Let's talk about how he was used a lot at Cal. And this is where I got a little more excited about him as a player. He's used in the A-gap a lot. Muggs the A-gap, then drops coverage. So fits well with simulated pressure schemes, I thought. The Ravens did some of that, but they actually probably trimmed it a little bit towards the end of the year because I think they were disadvantaging Roquan in terms of his ability to get back to the spot he needed to. It really showed up in a few games you know, they'd have rather not done that to him. I think with Teddy Buchanan, they're going to be willing to continue with some of their sim games, and we'll see how that goes. He has the speed to spy a mobile quarterback, so you see him doing that on some of the tape where he's actively mirroring in level two a quarterback who has you know, some good mobility. Very quick downhill trigger. What I liked about him more, you see that from a lot of inside linebackers. By the way, it's one of the things. If you're making up a checklist of what do I need to talk about in terms of inside linebacker, how good his downhill trigger is one of the things you want to know. And most inside linebackers are good at it. The guys who are not good at it tend to be guys who have already lost their responsibility due to the presence of a shiny object of some sort in terms of covering a running back most often. So, you know, Patrick Queen guilty of that a lot in his time with the Ravens, of just not keeping up with his assignment and whatnot in terms of the spot. But the guys who are on their assignment, they typically trigger very quickly downhill and know what they're doing. What I like about Buchanan more, and I saw this on tape and I'm very excited to see this, is I think he has way more understanding of the L2 to L3 route combinations than I typically see in a young player. All right. So the big vulnerability for young inside linebackers, for any inside linebacker, is the their ability to drop deep enough and to understand effectively enough what's going on behind them that they can impede passing lanes and create plays, tip balls on passes that are intended between level two and level three in zone packages. So the safety can't always help them. PFF typically will really nail the inside linebacker with the bulk of those underneath targets. That's why one of the reasons why you see big differences if you look at PFF safety targets and PFR, Pro Football Reference, safety targets in terms of how they are laid out. Eddie Jackson, I remember looking at, had 144 targets over his 4 years previous with the Ravens and 100 exactly by PFF. So PFF mostly assigns responsibility to the underneath defender, which puts an onus on that inside linebacker to really understand what's going on behind him. It's a difficult thing to learn. And anytime I talk about this with Michael Crawford, he always reminds me of that fact is, you know, you're expecting too much effectively from a young player to want him to be good at this as a rookie. But Buchanan appears to be ahead of the game in that way. So that's good. Now, in terms of his ability to defend the run, I think block shedding appears to be a big challenge for him. He doesn't have exceptional length at 31 3/8, but he's not so far below the line that you wouldn't figure he'd ever be able to shed blocks. I mean, he's not a good player in terms of getting off blocks. There's clearly guards climbing have too easy a time with him relative to other players, I would say. It was a little bit of a surprising need. Again, the glaring need at IDL was really something I thought they would address with the first pick in round four, or at least the second pick in round four. And the guy on the board that I really liked was Jordan Phillips of Maryland. So at the time of the draft, I would have said, yeah, I'll take Jordan Phillips for sure over Teddy Buchanan. But looking at Buchanan's tape, I kind of understand how and why they liked him. If I'm Patrick, not Patrick Queen, if I'm Trenton Simpson right now, I would not be a happy man. This clearly is an indictment of his future. Now, the Ravens didn't need an inside linebacker anyway because they lost Board, Harrison, and Welch, all very significant special teams contributors to free agency, and they needed to replace them. But Buchanan is a guy who I think will clearly be a big special teams player initially for the Ravens, and he should be a guy who would be a next man up in any situation where either Roquan or Simpson is hurt. So, I understand it a little more. I still think it's more of a need than a value selection. I think it's probably par value for the pick. I don't think it's an over. I don't think it's an under. I think he's right on par for the pick at number 129. And hopefully he has a good career for the Ravens. Could certainly be one of those guys who stays around and play some linebacker and play some special teams as well, and is valuable as a possibly a sub package linebacker, or possibly a guy who is just always there to take care of those games where you don't have one of your linebackers healthy. So in any case, I did end up kind of liking the pick, but not loving the pick with Teddy Buchanan. Let's move on. So the Ravens had a very weird trade they then make. And then I'll give you the trade here. They traded pick number 136 and they got back pick number 141. So they moved back five spots. And then later on, they picked up pick number 178 in exchange for giving up pick number 183. So to put this more succinctly, they moved up. So they moved back five spots in round four, and then actually between four and five. And then they moved up five spots in round, I guess it's six. Which to me didn't make any sense at all. I've never seen a trade like that. I can never remember one anywhere where a team moved up the exact same number of spots and the team trading back was okay with just the same number of spots exchanged in a different round. It does not work out for JJ Point reasons, although it's not a big deal. It just doesn't make sense conceptually that this would have happened. Now, there was somebody on Twitter who made a very good point. He said, one reason this could make sense is if the Ravens have a very large, very flat group of picks, and what they'd have to have is basically about 50 guys who were exactly at the same level, and they're indifferent to drafting any of them. Well, then moving up five picks at the back end might mean that it wouldn't be 50, maybe it's 30 guys. You decrease the possibility that you hit some cliff where the fall off to your next level of player is significant. Now, to me, I don't buy that explanation. It's good that somebody should do the thought experiment and say, hey, I can see a way that why this would work out. I just don't believe that would ever happen. I believe the grading is more subtle. And even if they're using half point grades on players, and I don't know exactly how they're doing it in the Ravens draft room right now, but even if they're rounding to half point grades on players, I don't think that they would find themselves in a situation where they had 30 guys all graded, say, a 6.5, such that they were indifferent to any of them, position and all. With the move down, and the team that trades back in the initial round is the one who takes risk. The team that trades up, they know exactly who they're getting, so they have less risk in the transaction. Sure, yeah, they do have risk because they're trading back in a later round, but this did not make sense from a risk perspective. I sent a DM to Jeff Srebeck, and he said, you know, this is a head scratcher for us too. We couldn't figure out why this is happening. So apparently I'm not alone in trying to figure that out. But the Ravens end up with pick number 141. During the time, by the way, they lost the ability to draft two very significant potential additions on the defensive line. And those are Josh Farmer and Cam Jackson. Either of them would have been a fairly big addition to the Ravens defensive line stable. But the pick they made, it might've been a pick they just knew was going to still be there. And that was Carson Vinson of Alabama A&M, the offensive tackle, pure developmental guy, 6'7", 314, 34.5-inch arms. The Ravens love their arm length. And so do I. So I was happy with that part. 5'12" in the 40. He's played 5 years all at Alabama A&M, so he's either 23 or 24. Carson Vinson playing 5 years at a small school is an immediate red flag unto itself. That you know, a guy like that, and Gray Zabel is similar, should be moving for NIL money at some big-time school if he was as pro-ready a prospect as you would hope. Now, he is not. He is at 14 bench reps. Otherwise solid testing across the board, but he's a vertical good feet athlete who really kind of looks like a beanpole at left tackle. Even in the Alabama A&M games where he's the biggest guy on the field by a wide margin, he still looks tall and thin relative to what you expect from an offensive lineman. We'll really need to develop a lot of functional strength over the years to fill out his frame. That'll be the biggest issue. There's time to do so, though. And this is one of the really nice things. The Ravens have got themselves in a good situation where they have both tackles for, in theory, 3 more years, but probably 2 more years at least with Ronnie Stanley, that they don't have to worry about not having 2 starting offensive tackles, and they have the time to develop another guy for, say, Vinson's years 3 and 4, which I think is what the Ravens are looking at right now. No way is Vinson getting on the field in 2025. He's just his body. There's no way he'd stand up to NFL combination. He'll play a little bit in the preseason in the second half. So we'll get a little bit taste of it then. And he'll do the same thing in 26, I would expect, assuming he's healthy at the point the preseason games are played. But he needs a lot of developmental time. It's a combination of things. I think the technique is actually, he's probably a little further along the line, but he still needs work there. And he needs a lot of work in terms of his body and getting stronger, getting bigger, and being an NFL sized guy. What else to say about him? He had one penalty every 149 snaps in FCS play, played in the Southwestern Athletic Conference. That is too high a rate, even though it's not, it generally would not be too high for a tackle. It's too high for him given his physical advantages over the player and over the other players in that conference. So I would want a draftable player to be even better than that, even if he was playing in the Big Ten, say, but I'd want a player playing at a lower level who is draftable to be even better still. So penalties are going to be a thing to watch. Hopefully he'll have plenty of time to work on that over the next year or two before he's really asked to play any in an NFL game. He does some things to win at that level that I think he is not going to be able to duplicate at the NFL level. So he has some vicious throwdowns, some very easy lockouts with his extreme length that are things that the hand fighting in the NFL is going to be too good for him. For a lot of the lockouts, and he won't have the physical strength to throw down an NFL edge rusher who actually knows how to counter the force he's applying there. So that'll be something. Don't know why he didn't seek an NIL deal with a Power Five school, but if I had to guess, I'd say whatever potential suitors he would have had were turned off by his lack of strength. So something they would certainly want to test significantly before they, you know, Alabama or a Clemson or something like that would pull him to their school and want to play left tackle for them. If you're looking at his positives, he has very good feet, good mirror. His anchor seems to be okay for the bull rush, but that's a place where he gets himself in trouble a little bit by playing high on some reps. I don't know how you could not play high when you're 6'7", but opponents seem to think that, yeah, maybe moving outside and then coming back on the body was a way that they would like to beat him. He's not a proactive striker with his arms. He didn't need to be there. He has a fairly good sense of space around him. I wouldn't call him a patty cake player, but he doesn't do as much proactive with his hands. He does have some lockout reps. I mentioned those earlier. He's really where he's trying to win by that. But most of the time I'd say he's trying to perimeterize the pocket and keep his arms out there so he can stay in front of you, make that first strike. And his opponents, frankly, were deathly afraid of allowing the first strike for a lot of the season. So he comes off with good pass rush scoring by PFF at that level. But I think, you know, obviously context is an enormous question there. We'll see him in the preseason or not at all in 2025. One thing I've been kind of frustrated by in the last few drafts is that the Ravens have missed out on some of the good developmental tackles, the good size and shape guys in that left tackle pool. The last one they really drafted was Gregory Sinat, and they couldn't find a roster spot to keep him around with that incredible deep 2018 draft. They had to cut him, and everybody knew he'd be gone if they cut him, that he wouldn't last on the practice squad. And sure enough, it didn't. I don't think he even cleared waivers. I think there were multiple claims made on Sinat at that point. He was a small school guy from Wagner, right? Wagner, I think. So same thing would happen to Vincent. So he will be kept on the 53-man roster. He might be on injured reserve or something, but he will be kept on the 53-man roster until he's ready to go in a year or two. If I'm looking at another guy that I would hope he'd be similar to, Spencer Brown had a great developmental arc with Buffalo. Wasn't a very good player his first year, and he is now. And now I think the Bills have just paid him this offseason, in fact, and are bringing him back for more time. That's the kind of player that I've been craving for the Ravens to pick, and Vincent might be that guy. I think there's some reasons to believe that Vincent is starting from a little bit lower level. The fifth round is sensible, and the pick itself has good value. I did not like the fact that they gave up on Josh Farmer and Cam Jackson there. Cam Jackson, if you don't know, is one of the two fatties from Florida, and they are both have, you know, serious eating habit concerns. But Desmond Watson weighed in at 464 pounds at some point during the season, and he apparently is down to 437 now, and other teams are looking to get him significantly under 400 by the time he's ready to play. So he was went as an undrafted free agent to the Bucks, in case you're wondering. So the Ravens missed out on him as a potential nose tackle replacement for Michael Pierce. Josh Farmer, another guy they missed out on during this thing. So I can't grade Vincent relative to the guys they lost out on. But I thought from strategically at that moment, they lost value in terms of the pick. And I think that Vinson as a pick at that point is a perfectly reasonable value. I think he's on par, not too high, not too low. I'm fine drafting him with an early pick in the fifth round. But I'm bummed a little bit about the other players they lost in the process. Got to make your choices. The Ravens made the choice. They said developmental offensive tackle was more important. Let's move on. Talk about the next pick, who's Bilal Kone of Western Michigan. Guys had a long and winding road to get to the NFL. So he's picked in round six, pick number 178 for the Ravens. 6'1", 190, 30 7/8-inch arms, 4.43, so another speed guy they found in the late rounds. Don't have any age on him, but he played 2 years of JUCO ball. Then he played 1 year at Indiana State and 2 years at Western Michigan. So he's either 23 or 24 in 2025. It's one of the few guys that the Ravens really sacrificed on an age basis. He's got a very weird testing profile with an outstanding three cone, but very poor vert and shuttle. You don't often see a divergence in the three cone and the shuttle, at least not too often. So that's an unusual combination. Allowed 8.1 yards per target last year at Western Michigan. So you got the context issue to start with. And then he allows 8.1 yards per target, which is in the 26th percentile of the corners who had at least 300 coverage snaps in 2024. So anyway, he's a guy that that I would have real questions about. Now, there is a big mitigating factor, and that is if you look at whether he's playing left corner or right corner, he switched during the game. So anyway, because he played left corner and right corner, apologize there for that. He's clearly chasing the opponent's best receiver. So if you look at that, look at the number one corner. And in fact, Bilal Kone actually wore number one and is clearly the best cornerback at Western Michigan. He was following the best receiver for the opponent. So it's a case where I think his coverage snaps were hurt, his coverage metrics were hurt by facing the best opponent play after play. He had a good career FBS coverage metrics for passes defense, two interceptions and 19 pass breakups. And that's good, but the 9.5% conversion is not good. Of conversion of percentage of total passes defense, and that's 19 plus two, that are interceptions, which is only two, is only 9.5%. That's too low. I think a number between 20 and 25% would be average. You're really good cornerbacks and a lot of your good safeties are higher than that. At a 13.9% missed tackle rate, it's adequate, but not exceptional. Excuse me. So if you looked at individual games, he was really taken to the woodshed by Akron. His assignments were 7 of 7 on receptions for 162. That included a 79-yard play. No TDs involved, but he certainly got beaten for some significant yardage in that game. One thing you notice if you look at tape is that I think he has kind of a lack of transitional speed. So he's a guy at 6'1", 190 who is comfortable playing up close to the line of scrimmage in press. And you certainly want that on third and short, third and medium, where you have to defend the sticks in a different way with its 3 or 5 yards to go. You just can't allow the slant route in the same way you do with off coverage on an earlier down or some of the other routes that get the ball to the outside quickly and allow the wide receiver to make a play. So you got to play close to the line of scrimmage. And then press has to be part of that disruption. He's a guy who does not really have great transitional speed either off his press move or off the top of the stem. So it's a problem I think that he will have to overcome at the NFL level, and it will be an issue on in terms of whether or not he's a guy who can play at all at this level. Is can he solve some of that? It's some footwork issues that go with that that are probably contributing. To the problem. He does find the football in the air very effectively. In fact, both of the Ravens corners that they drafted are guys who excel on the ball skill basis, as does Malachi Starks at safeties. The Ravens went heavily on ball skills in this draft. I think we all like that. I think we're done with basically the speed corners who can stay in your hip pocket but can't find the ball, which is really what both JAD and Brandon Stevens were. So definitely a change in philosophy in terms of who they drafted at corner. Kone has two penalties and 367 coverage snaps in 2024. That was a big improvement on his career rate. It's a pretty good ratio of one every 183.5. There are guys who are better at corner, but that ain't bad. I would honestly say if I look at this pick, my immediate reaction is this is more similar to Caillou Blue Kelly than a guy that is obviously going to work out for me for the Ravens. Caillou Blue Kelly had a similarly unimpressive final year in college with over 8 yards per target. It might have been about 8.4, so it was a little bit worse in Caillou's case. But he played for a very bad Stanford team. He was chasing good receivers, so there were issues for him as well that I think the Ravens probably saw as mitigating factors. In Kone's case, I hope he ends up being a better player than Kelly, who was cut after his first camp with the Ravens and picked up elsewhere. And he's bounced around the league a little bit, but I believe he may be completely out of the NFL now. So, other than the K to start their last name, I hope there's not a lot of similarity with Caillou Blue Kelly. If I had to guess, I'm guessing the Ravens liked something about his interview, his tenacity, his intelligence. I mean, there's probably something else they're drawing on beyond what's actually happening on the field, but I want to see traits, which I think he has, that are backed up by coverage metrics that corroborate that. And I just don't see that with Kone, and that's one of my issues with the pick. It's in round 6. I wouldn't evaluate this on a value basis anymore at this point. It's a needs pick. If it works out, it'll really work out well. It could really work out well, and it'd be exciting to have basically maybe a number 4 or number 5 corner out of the 6th round. That would be a big win, but not sure it will. And if it doesn't, you know, the Ravens have shot their shot and it didn't work out. Move on to the next round 6 pick, which was number 186. So the Ravens are drafting in rapid fire order here, is Tyler Loop, the kicker from Arizona. Now, I think if you look at what happened in round 6, Borgalis was taken by New England at number 182. The Ravens may have felt the pressure at that point to take Tyler Loop. And there's often a case is there's, you know, birds on a wire and all the kickers or all the punters go at one point in the draft. This is a place where the Borgalis was a big name, Borgalis. He was a guy that Loop was a guy I think the Ravens probably liked for his big leg. Kicked a 62-yard field goal. There's an interesting tape out of there of him making consecutively, I believe, a 65 and a 70-yard field goal in his time during college. So those are not in-game field goals. Those are practice field goals, of course. So the Ravens may have had a somewhat thin board, and they decided they had to take Loop after Borgalis was off the board. First kicker ever drafted by the Ravens. It will make for a very interesting camp battle. And, you know, today the news has come up. The Ravens also signed another UDFA kicker, which I think probably flags a cut for Justin Tucker. We haven't, you know, nothing's been said officially, and you know, the Ravens are holding their water on the decision to cut Tucker. I think there's probably a pretty good chance it happens after June 1st, but they have set themselves up so if they have to move on sooner, they can by retaining a single pre-June 1 cut that can be designated as post-June 1 cut, which they really need to do in Tucker's case because it pushes a lot of the pain in terms of cap purposes out into 2026. But I think the handwriting is probably on the wall with the combination of a UDFA signing and a draft pick. If it was just a draft pick, I'd still say it didn't look great, but it's a competition. If it was a UDFA only, wouldn't be worried about it at all. That's happened with some of the great kickers that have kicked around the NFL since then, Lutz and Gonneau and other people have come in to challenge Ravens kickers of the past. Cameron Dicker. But the fact that they would otherwise potentially have three kickers in camp tells me no way in hell are they sticking where they are. So I'm afraid this is the end of the Justin Tucker era. And I'll just say, regardless of what the outcome is of all the allegations, the legal trouble and whatnot that seem to be going on, the allegations, he's had a great career in Baltimore. I hope we never lose sight of who he was as a football player. I hope he's not, a player that can't come back and be part of the Ravens Ring of Honor. I hope this does not affect in any way his Hall of Fame credentials. I think he'll have advocates and it's interesting. Times change. They won't change with regard. I think the direction of things is wrong for sexual misconduct. I think that's likely to be more looked down upon over time if I had to guess the general trend. But if you look at gambling, the trend is exactly opposite. You know, Pete Rose banned for life for betting on his own team. And by the way, that's the real problem, is that he bet on the games that he was involved in. But the other, the fact that Major League Baseball and all professional sports have completely gotten in bed with online gambling as a huge portion of what they do, basically taking their cue from how the UK economy is built. I mean, the UK economy to an enormous degree is built around gambling. And, the American economy now, the Americans, fortunately, we produce other products and services that are a large portion of the GDP. But one of the ways that sports has to build revenue that was available to them was to get in bed with gambling. And so they now look like hypocrites a little bit for telling Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle that they shouldn't be working with Atlantic City casinos in the 1980s. Just looks freaking silly as hell at the time. So anyway. We'll move on. We'll see how soon Justin Tucker is welcome back to Baltimore. It was nice to see that Ray Rice was back and with his family, for one of those pregame introductions they did, or maybe a halftime introduction, whatever they do it. Was nice to see him back in the stadium. Great Raven and obviously contributed a lot to the franchise. We'll move on to pick number 203 in round six, which was LaJonte Wester of Colorado. A lot of you will know him because you've watched tape of Shadur. And in fact, the big time throw that Shadur had, where he basically just throws the ball up for grabs on the left side of the end zone for the play that tied the Baylor game in week one. So they were down 34-27, I want to say, or about that. Shadur basically rolled left, just threw the ball up for grabs, and it's LaJonte Wester who snuck free in the end zone as his opposing defensive number was falling down, and was able to make a beautiful diving catch on a flotation device thrown up by Shadur. That's thought of as a Shadur highlight. It's a Wester highlight. That's what it is. So anyway, Wester, 5'10", 163, would make him one of the smallest players in the entire NFL. I think there's one guy playing in the 155-ish range right now. So he would be one of the very smallest. 29 3/4-inch arms. Plays bigger than that, by the way. I'll get to that. 4.46 in the 40. He turned 23 in March. He played 4 years at Florida Atlantic before he moved and played his last year at Colorado. In terms of his testing, there isn't anything positive except for his speed. So he's a speed guy and uses that extremely well, combined with that size, to be a very sudden athlete. And we see that with Zay Flowers, that he doesn't really need to sit in the chair the same way that bigger, taller receivers do in order to decelerate, which is bad for two reasons. Well, it's not bad for two reasons, but it's a handicap for two reasons. The first is that you actually can't change directions as quickly. And the second is, by starting to sit in the chair, you flag that to your defensive counterparty there. They watch you. Oh, he's sinking his hips. And
if you're looking for a better way to unwind, focus, or even get a good night's sleep, listen up. Let me tell you about Mood, the online cannabis company that's changing the game when it comes to functional gummies. They've crafted a whole line up of federally legal THC blends designed to help with everything from stress to sleep to mental clarity and even some spicier needs if you're into that. Now, what makes Mood different? They go beyond just THC. They pair it with herbs and adaptogens to create targeted effects that you won't find in any other dispensary. And every gummy is made with pesticide-free, small-farm American cannabis, so you're getting quality that you can trust. I've tried their sleep gummies, and let me tell you, takes about 15 minutes, and I'm out cold, no grogginess, no weird side effects, getting some of the best sleep I've gotten in my life when I take one of these gummies. And if you need a mood boost, there are Epic Euphoria gummies, game changers. And right now, Mood is giving listeners 20% off their first order by using the promo code RAVENS at checkout. So head on over to mood.com, find the perfect gummy for whatever life throws your way, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS to save 20%.
It could be a double move, and so they can mitigate their reaction to how you're sinking your hips, but they also know that in order to break to the inside, you need to sink. And so they can do other things to potentially undercut the route in that direction if they want to. Anyway, it's an early flag for a corner. With a bigger receiver, it's one of the things that helps them not bail out, not turn their hips too quickly, is the fact that they know they have to sink to counter. So they can wait a little longer to transition into long speed if it's going to be a go route. All right. So Wester, also I mentioned he plays bigger in terms of catch radius and contested ability. I was fairly amazed on what he was able to do with some of the throws that Shadur had outside his frame in terms of adjusting to the ball. And again, I thought he was quite good on that. And he has a very good contested catch record. So last year, he made 8 of 12 contested catches. It wasn't a real high percentage of his overall throws. He had, 13% contested catches, 13% contested targets as a percentage of catches, which is in the 20th percentile of receivers with 50 plus targets this last year. So that's not a lot, and you wouldn't expect it because he's a shifty slot receiver, a guy who has a lot of gadget plays where those are never contested. So he's going to be a guy who will typically get uncontested catches, but it's nice to see that when contested catches did arise, he was still quite good at converting those. His background is a punt returner. And in the last 2 years, he's averaged 16.0 yards per return the last two seasons with 2 touchdowns and 0 muffs. I would be literally shocked if he was not right there in terms of the punt return competition with players like Tylan Wallace, potentially the other corner that the Ravens drafted as well, Robert Longerbeam. So he might be involved as well in that competition. As a receiver, and he's playing in a pretty good offense. Not only does he play with Shadur, who had a good year, but he also is playing with Travis Hunter, who takes a lot of the safety help away. He can drag the field very effectively going across, and he presented himself very well all year to Shadur in doing exactly that. He caught 74 of 92 balls for 931 yards. That works out to 10.1 yards per target. I was actually surprised that 10.1 yards per target, which is outstanding in the NFL, 90th percentile at least, but it was only 81st percentile in college. There are a lot of guys who are too good for college football, basically, or there's a lot bigger variation in talent level in college football that creates more breadth of yards per target results. So that's interesting. In terms of his other metrics, we'll go through this really quickly. His routes per target were 5.7, which is in the 14th percentile. Now, he's competing for targets with Travis Hunter. I would look at as being a big deal there. His yards per route run were at 1.79, 38th percentile. His ADOT, 8.0, the 14th percentile. So he's definitely a lot of gadget plays are dragging down that number. But he's decidedly effective moving right to left or left to right. Probably more often right to left to drag his coverage guy in trail and presents himself very well to Shadur crossing like that. So he's a guy that I thought can help the Ravens. That the Ravens run a lot of those deep over kind of plays that maybe the level two route that you would see on their very typical boot plays, but there's lots of opportunities to get him there. The other thing he did very well for Shadur, who is similar to Lamar Jackson in some ways, that it creates a lot of extended plays, is that he would be done running a route and then he'd start running his secondary route to try and bail out Shadur. So he's got some highlights that are about that. He's got lots of plays where he's very clearly trying to find space so Shadur can make an off-schedule throw. So that will work very well with Lamar. And it's one of the reasons why I expect him to be part of the offense pretty much immediately this year. Continue on with some of the metrics. His yak per reception was 7.1 in the 88th percentile. Now, some of that you got to realize is because he's getting the ball a lot behind the line of scrimmage, there are better yak opportunities there. Some of that is in red yards, meaning he's got to get back to the line of scrimmage, and that counts for his yak, but not in terms of his yards per reception. So it's not as valuable, but nonetheless, that's a very good yak per reception number. His drop percentage was 3.9 in the 77th percentile. I was surprised that there's 23% of the receivers drop the ball less than 3.9% of the time. That's actually much higher than I would have guessed. And the QBR throwing to him was 136.0. Now you say, but he had Sanders, and the truth of the matter was the Colorado quarterbacks in aggregate were at 115.1. So if you want to talk about it, this in terms of beating the spread, he did so by over 20 points. So LaJonte Wester really looks like a ball player to me. I think he'll take some of the gadget plays away from Zay Flowers. It means Zay Flowers can be more dangerous, more effective for the Ravens offense in terms of drawing safeties out over the top. If you look at him as a receiver, I talked about some things, but extremely sudden, plants his foot in the ground and goes. And that's just creates a lot of separation at the top of the stem doing exactly that. He makes space for throws on extended plays. I talked about that. Really good ball tracking skills. That Baylor miraculous touchdown in week one to get the game tied is one where he tracked the ball and nobody else was. Kind of a weird play, but definitely all the way a Wester highlight. Finds holes in zone defense to present himself. Again, a lot of that time that is that crossing stuff, but he's capable of doing it otherwise as well with a curl route or whatever it might be. His missed tackles forced, which are a little bit low, are all elusiveness. He doesn't really have any power to his game. I wouldn't say he's exactly like a fall down king like Marquise Brown, where every catch he's looking to find out what's the safest patch of grass I can drop my body onto. But he's also not a guy who really breaks tackles very easily. He's in the middle, probably a little bit more like Flowers, where he's really trying to make a play after the catch, tries to run through the contact and then goes down. I think he'll contribute immediately. I think this is going to be a fresh legs offense where they have a lot of rotation of their five skill position players, and he'll be one of the guys that comes on the field. The team has a lot of offensive weapons right now, despite the fact that they didn't draft anybody at tight end and running back. They're playing the five cards they were dealt there, and they've got a ton of guys now at wide receiver. And I would expect every single one of a six receiver crew not only to be active because they're going to need him for special teams, but also to contribute in terms of being rotated through. So hopefully this is a season where we see a lot more of Walker, say, and we see a lot more of we'll see some of LaJonte Wester to take some of that gadget role. But I would, if I had to over under his targets right now, I'd say 28 for the season, 1.5 targets per game. I think that'd be good. I think they could easily fall in love with his production in that sense. I think he fits the mold exactly for what the Ravens want in terms of a punt returner who can also make an offensive contribution. That's what Deontay was supposed to be last year, Deontay Hardy. But that didn't really come true. I think that, much more likely that works out with Wester this year. And one of the reasons I'm so bullish on his target number, even though 28 may not seem like an extreme number, it's a lot for a rookie, is because he'll be on the active roster every single week as a punt returner. I don't see a way they get out of that. I think, you know, Tylan Wallace is another guy who will be on the roster. I think he's, you know, if I'm handicapping the punt return job right now, I think 80% Wester gets it and 20% that Wallace gets it. 20% Wallace or Field, let's say, gets it. Just because of some of the problems Wallace has had in recent years. That said, Wallace is a critically important special teams player, and so they're still going to have him on the roster weekly basis. The guy who still is at risk of being non-activated in some games where they want to go a different route or maybe have an extra running back or an extra offensive lineman, really more an extra running back, would be Walker. Might not be active every single game. I love that pick. This pick at number 203, it could easily become a very high value return. If you look back to Jermaine Lewis, he was drafted in the fifth round in 1996 and ended up being one of the great picks in Ravens history in terms of what he did. I think the possibility is there for Wester to be as good a player as Jermaine Lewis. It's a big ask, but I think the ceiling is potentially higher. Well, the ceiling is higher than where Jermaine Lewis ended up being. But Jermaine Lewis averaged, I think it was 15.0 yards per return during his time with the Ravens. I think we could see a really outstanding punt returner who also makes contributions at the wide receiver role. All right, let's move on. Pick number 210. The Ravens finally got a taste of the defensive line depth in the draft by drafting Aeneas Peebles out of Virginia Tech. 6'0", 282. So I think he probably dropped some weight to run at the combine. It probably paid off by running 494. But he's a shorter armed guy at 31 3/8. He'll be 24 in September after playing 4 years at Duke and a year at Virginia Tech. He really has mediocre testing in most other respects, but he did do 28 bench reps, which is good. Even with the shorter arm length, that's a good number. He's primarily a passing down guy in college with 57% of his snaps coming on those plays. So I'm looking forward to his NFL future and wondering how are the Ravens going to get him on the field, because the Ravens don't really have room for a situational pass rushing three tech when they have Madubuike taking effectively all those snaps. Madubuike has been an iron man, in terms of his ability to continue to play well. By the way, I really had that one flagged wrong last year because I thought he'd do a lot better playing, fewer snaps, and he played more snaps and he continued to play well. And I think he's a guy who as more pressure is generated around him, we'll even get more cleanup. But Peebles is a guy, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge to get him on the field. In terms of who he is as a player, he's a situational a guy who wins with leverage, hand fighting, and he has already very polished technique. He has a distinct toolkit of moves. And so when I was doing the defensive line show with Jake Vogel, Jake had him, I think, at number 10 overall. So he really loved him. And in fact, on draft night, he was asking me to put him in a set of players we had identified as potential round three choices. I love working with that spreadsheet with all the interested people that are online on draft night. By the way, if you didn't see it, take a look at it and see if you want to be a part of that next year, because it's a really fun process the way we do it. And we try and take evaluations from anybody who might be in the stream as well as the other panelists to add players. But anyway, Peebles was a guy that he identified as a potential third round pick. To me, he was a fourth round par and a fifth round value. The Ravens got him in round six. So I think he's a great value potentially for them. The overlap with Madubuike, I think it will be resolved in this way. First of all, if Madubuike gets injured, you're very happy you have Aeneas Peebles as a backup three tech who can be paired with Travis Jones and can do some good work against guards in a one-on-one matchup like that and create pressures. But I think you might see both of them on the field at the same time when the Ravens have the lead and the opponent is in a position where they have to pass pretty much every play. And that can happen at the end of the half. They don't even have to have the lead then. When you have to move down the field and you want to get good pass rushers on, even on first down, it makes sense to have them on for that. And it makes sense, you know, with a 2-touchdown lead in the fourth quarter, say, where you know the other team has to pass to catch up and you're not too darn concerned about how effectively they're going to run the football, which is where Peebles is going to be most challenged as an NFL player, although he wasn't terrible in college in that regard. So ideally, the Ravens would have gotten a 3-tech who could play early downs and take away some of the workload from Madubuike there. They still have Broderick Washington around. I always got to check myself and see if I'm saying Brandon Williams, because I do that all the time. But Broderick Washington around, who can play some of that 3-tech role on early downs. But the Peebles will be a guy who probably plays rotationally within that group. He's a below average tackler with a 14.4% career missed tackle rate. He has 63 stops and 16 missed tackles, which is a 3.9 to 1 relationship. Not exactly what you want in terms of a guy. And obviously his size is not going to play nearly as well at the NFL level as it did in college. He played a little heavier than that, than 282, but I expect him to probably be a guy who plays right at 300 or 305 at the NFL level. They'll try and get him to take on additional weight and maintain his strength and mobility with that. I've always heard, and somebody could probably speak to this, that players are asked to carry as much weight as they possibly can and maintain their athleticism. And when they're having to make sacrifices in athleticism, then it becomes a question of should they carry the additional weight or not. So they have to be constantly on that efficient frontier of weight and athleticism and managing that. So let's get back to his pass rushing for a little bit, because he has a toolkit that includes a really nice spin move. And I just have to tell you, that's exceedingly rare for an interior defensive lineman. They almost never have a spin move ready to go. For starters, they're often getting pinballed on the inside between the center and a guard, and they really don't want to be spinning themselves with the additional risk that comes with that. But Peebles has a lot of one-on-one matchups against the guard, but as a three coming from the outside shoulder of that guard. And he is not afraid at all to use a spin move to try and beat his man. And that's was something interesting to see. Very high motor, and a very high motor arms and legs. So arms, he's a violent hand fighter who's really trying to do that. And by the way, he has to be. His length does not allow for him to be a passive hand fighter, or you know, a guy who just wants to use a rip move or whatever. He's a guy who needs to combine violent hands with other pass rush technique to beat his opponent, given he's got 31 3/8 inch arms. Definitely see the high motor continue on his feet too. Gets in the backfield, a lot of very disruptive pressure there, and I think that's probably the only way he's going to be successful playing run defense, is to sacrifice anything that might be asked of him. Well, not anything that might be asked of him. The Ravens have to not ask of him to be a two-gap player, because that's not who he is. He'll be a penetrator. He will bifurcate the backfield. I know that's on some people's bingo cards here. In fact, I'd be saying it. And then he will force running backs into difficult choices about whether to move left or right of the penetration he creates, which often is all you need for somebody else to make a play, is make some penetration, force the back to make a decision. It's usually between bad and awful, or it can be between bad and awful, sometimes between good and bad, and they'll make the bad choice. But oftentimes it's between bad and awful. That's giving your opponent a dilemma instead of giving them a problem they can solve. I like that. And I think he if he's used by the Ravens on early downs, I think they're best off just letting him continue to be kind of the natural penetrator he can be. And that means they'll have to over-rely on gap discipline from the inside linebackers and really good ability to stand up to double teams from whoever their nose tackle is on early downs. So it's a lot to ask. And the Ravens might be going with some younger guys there that they really need to have coached up in a way that is a lot to ask for rookie players. So I look forward to it. And Peebles is a guy I'm still excited about. 7.2 pass rush productivity was 10th of 380 interior defensive linemen. That's in the 97th percentile. It's mostly pressures. He has a very low finish rate, was just 16.2%. That's low even for the interior defensive line. And I think this is probably fairly apparent, but I'll say it anyway, that finish rates on the interior are a lot lower than they are for edge rushers. So Mike Green's 46% rate of finishes, that would never happen on the interior. The highest ones are probably a little below 40 or right around 40. That you see on the interior, but and you have guys at edge who can be up in the 50s. So you really just don't see that in the interior. All right. What do I want to say also about him? I think it's very rare that a sixth round pick will definitely make the team, but I think in Peebles' case, there's virtually no chance that he'll be cut due to the lack of interior defensive line depth. I think he's a sure thing to make the team. And the Ravens really have a need to get younger. I think he addresses that directly. I think he's an excellent value pick. He was my 18th interior defensive lineman in what was a very deep class. There's been recent years, and this is the end of the COVID bubble that they're just moving through here, but there's been recent years where the 18th defensive lineman would be undrafted. This is not such a case this year. I think the 18th defensive lineman should have gone in round four. So we just have a little bit different situation this year. I think that's about all I have to say about him. So like the value pick a lot there, and I need to hurry up and get this done given how long we're going here. Next pick down the board is number 212 is Robert Longerbeam of Rutgers, 5'11", 175, 31.5-inch arms, 4.39 of a 40. So they got another real speed guy. He's played 5 years at Rutgers, so he's either 23 or 24 in 2025. I don't know which. I can't find an age on him, so lots of scrubbing going on out there. He had an excellent three-cone and a mediocre shuttle, a very, very unusual combination. He may have the length to stay on the outside despite some size, speed, and change of direction that really screams out slot corner. So his size in particular, 5'11", 175, I mean, that's like Tavon Young size, a little bit larger. He's a little bit taller, but about that same weight. And it would be unusual for that guy in this NFL to stay on the outside, but he might have the length to do it. And he's definitely been a crafty outside corner that brings some skills to the table. Team captain at Rutgers, two-time honorable mention as all Big Ten. And I like this one, a four-time academic All-Big Ten. So he's a guy, hopefully, he's going to pick up the playbook fairly quickly. If you have a system you need to acclimate into, a guy who's been an academic All-American, that carries some weight for me in terms of his ability to pick up the book. He has very real ball skills. 13 passes defensed, led the Big Ten in 2024. He had 42 in his career, including 5 interceptions in 53 college games. By the way, the reason I mentioned that, including the 5 interceptions, is that unlike the NFL, where interceptions are a subset of passes defensed, in college, passes defensed are separate from interceptions. So everybody has they do it a little bit differently in terms of how they aggregate stats. They get a little different passer rating. That's a different handling of rush yards per carry in the way they deal with sacks. So everything's a little different, but anyway, for passes defense, that's one of the significant differences. His career interceptions, and I tried to look back at that and see what I was seeing in terms of a consistency of style, but he's very good with what I consider to be one of the most difficult types of interceptions for a corner to make, and that's the underneath zone interception. So you think of the predators, the guys who really rack up interception totals are Marcus Peters, back end cover three, zone corner, looks at the quarterback the whole time, breaks on a route whenever he thinks it's a good gamble, and those guys pick up tons of picks. The guys who are playing underneath in zone coverage don't have that good advantage. They're kind of like underneath linebackers. They have to read the quarterback very well. They have to be very spatially aware, and they have to get to a spot where they can make a play on that football. And he did an outstanding job of that. So, two of the interceptions I saw were exactly that sort of play. Ball was underthrown in each case, but he had maneuvered himself into a spot where his interception radius overlaid a lot of the the potential field on that side in front of the receiver, and the guy who was on the back end of the zone coverage, and it might have been cover three or might have been some other zone package, was coming up on the play, might have been able to make a ball on a play on either ball, but the underneath play was already made by Longerbeam. Another part, he had a man coverage offensive left side undercut interception as well. So I like to see that. I like to definitely see anybody, a corner who could break at the top of the stem and make a play on the ball. And that's what his other one was there that I saw. I missed two of his interceptions to know what they are. I don't know if he's got a deep man coverage interception or something where he followed somebody down the sideline, or whether it might've been a tip ball that he picked up or whatever it might've been, but I didn't see the other two interceptions. He also forced 5 fumbles and recovered 2. You really notice this. Great second man of the ball skills. He has a big club move he applies whenever he's making a tackle, on particularly on his assignment, but even when he comes off his guy to make the tackle on somebody else's assignment. Looks like Humphrey from a few years ago, and really trying to club the football loose as his first priority in making a tackle. Love that in terms of how you approach it. Receivers do things that put themselves out of good body position, in particular of the ball relative to how they're carrying it when they're trying to make a twisty turny move in the middle of the field. They've got Mark Andrews in a little bit of trouble, obviously, in the Buffalo game, a lot of trouble, let's face it. It typically does not get running backs in the same sort of trouble. They're too much of their game is dependent on how they hold the football high and tight and keep it secured all the time. But with receivers, there are opportunities there, and he's very good at getting the football loose. Coverage metrics I'll go through pretty quickly. Now, I'll give you the mitigating factor at the end here, but yards per target were 6.6. That's in the 59th percentile, so he's fine in that category, but not really up to the standard of your typical draftable player who I'd want to be higher than that among all college cornerbacks that had 300-plus coverage snaps. Opposition passer rating was 73.3 in the 68th percentile, so good there. Coverage snaps per target were 6.35. That was in the 25th percentile. Now, why were they throwing at him so often? Well, the answer is very similar to Kone, is that he was traveling to follow the team's best opposing receiver, which really dinged his statistics. So it certainly dinged how often they were throwing at him, but it also dinged how successful they were throwing at him because he's covering their number one receiver. So his penalties were per coverage snap were in the 40th percentile. I don't have the actual metric on that, but I do have the percentile. His yaks per reception was 6.0, 16th percentile. So he's allowing some significant yardage after the catch there. Not a good thing. I didn't really try and parse out where that was coming from, whether it was a few big plays or whether it was screen passes that were underneath on his side where somehow the guy's getting free and making a big play. I didn't try and parse that out, but it's not a good overall rate, obviously. Had 11 missed tackles in 24. His missed tackle rate was 20.4%, which was in the 13th percentile. So that's something I would not fault him for anything he's doing with regard to try to punch the ball free, because I think the payoff is worth some significant additional risk. But cornerbacks who have trouble tackling, that can be a real problem for you if you have those in your secondary. And the Ravens have tried to get by a lot of times in the past with safeties who had trouble tackling, most notably recently Geno Stone, where they got a big payoff in interceptions from it. But they lived with a fair amount of missed tackles. Billy Bowman from Oklahoma had that in spades coming out in this draft. I mean, he was a guy I was actually hoping the Ravens would get too. But Longerbeam is a guy who he's going to have to learn how to tackle better. His stops per missed tackle career only 1.09 to 1, which is in the 21st percentile. Again, he's probably going up against some bigger receivers who can certainly be too much for him in terms of size and might be too much for him after the catch as well. So I haven't really tried to diagnose exactly where all that yak is coming from. If you're looking for a hopeful comp for him, I'd say he's a slightly larger version of Tavon Young. Good coverage, aggressive ball production, both before and after the catch. Occasionally does get beat for some big plays. That would be great, by the way. We wouldn't want Tavon Young with all the injuries probably that he had, but Tavon Young, when he was on the field, he was one hell of a football player. And the Ravens knew it. They signed him a big contract, and that didn't work out, unfortunately, because of additional injuries, but great player. I think he obviously must improve his tackling to succeed in the NFL. One of the things I do notice is that he lays his shoulder into an opponent a lot. So he has a club move he uses probably more commonly when he thinks the football might come loose, but he also doesn't really wrap up in the way I'd expect a corner to tackle. He more like is trying to throw his mass into the center of the opponent and see if he can get him down that way. I think that if you look at who's affected by his arrival, I think this further reduces the chance that JAD will make the team. So I didn't think his chances were all that good, but a combination of Kone and Longer Beam are probably going to push him to be traded, I would guess, like a Jabo at the end of camp, if I had to make my guess. Move on to the last pick. I like the value on the Longer Beam pick. Hard for me not to like a sixth round pick, but I do have some concerns that he might not ever work out. He could be a guy who, either one of them, frankly, could be a guy who's cut before they ever play an NFL game. And Longer Beam and Kone, two guys. I think if they told me you'll get one good cornerback out of those two, I'd be very excited about that possibility. If they said you get one cornerback who makes the team, I'd probably want 1.2, but I'd live with one. And in terms of expected value, obviously. But anyway, it is what it is. Let's move on. Talk about Robert Longerbeam of Rutgers. Not Robert Longerbeam. Moving down to Garrett Dellinger of LSU, who is their seventh round pick at number 243, a guard center. He's played guard so far, just a very little bit of center. And he's also played left tackle. 6'4", 325. He is built like an NFL lineman right now. 32 7/8-inch arms, ran 5'10 at his pro day, 23 in February, 4 years at LSU. There were injury concerns about him. He did have 30 bench reps. He had great jumps. He did it all at his pro day, and his testing was outstanding pretty much across the board. And there was big concern because he was injured in week 9. He had something called tightrope surgery. Some people probably know what that is, but it was to treat a high ankle sprain. And he needed to have a cord inserted that wraps the tibia and fibula, a braided polyethylene cord, to anchor the tibia and fibula together at the base, which allows for the original bone positioning and faster healing than using screws to do the same thing. And I guess they may be more concerned with the risk of infection with screws, I would guess. But I don't know how new this tightrope procedure has been. It may have been around for 30 years, for all I know. But like screws, you never replace those things. So in theory, that cord will stay in, and only rarely, and probably this is infection related, they would take it out. But I was kind of fascinated looking some of this up on Google to try and find out what this surgery was, and it's clear that whatever he did, he recovered very well from the injury he had. He has had some other previous injuries. One was a broken hand. That's more of an acute injury that I wouldn't be too concerned about being a chronic thing. He had a grade 2 MCL sprain. That obviously could be something that he'd be vulnerable to. I think whatever questions you had about his injury, his testing answers it. And he is ready to compete in 2025. So even though he's a seventh round draft pick, and there are questions about his ability, certainly, he's a guy who could fit into the Ravens' plans as early as this year. He is the combination you want to see in terms of being a solid pass blocker with meh run blocking. I can live with that combination. I can't live the other way around. And that's why I'm okay with who Daniel Faalele is. And I'm occasionally not okay with who Tyler Linderbaum is. Tyler Linderbaum is a not so great an average NFL pass blocker who is a very good run blocker. And that's not the combination I want. I'd rather have it the other way around. And Dillinger gives you that. Length is good solid for a guard, is very good for a center at 32 and 7/8. So if he were ever moved to center in the future, and I think that's one of the things the Ravens are eyeing, is the Linderbaum contract situation. And Dillinger, as I would see it right now, would probably be the guy in 2026 to step in, assuming the Ravens didn't draft a center next year and Dillinger, you know, effectively looks the part wherever he plays this year. From the tape, I'd say he is a plus combination blocker. It looks like he releases on time. It looks like he is decisive in L2. I want to see that. You know, you want to be able to move to L2. That's kind of a minimum standard. He has that ability. And then you want a guy who shows that he knows what he wants to do once he gets to L2. You know, maintain momentum, go find a block, look for work, all the things you need to do when you're doing that. But I thought also he probably is a guy who's releasing that block on time. And, you know, you don't have to finish that block. There are other guys in this draft that's been a problem for. I think he looks like more like a quote unquote team player who will help the center, get the guy up on his pins on one pin. And then the center can finish the block and look like the hero. He moves to L2 and picks up some other work that he can do to extend that run play. I don't have any issues with him holding the back end. He's a huge guard to come into the league at 325 pounds. There are probably fewer of them each year. You do find, you know, there are some mammoth men, Ben Cleveland, and, you know, coming in at 350 or 356 or whatever he was. And it's not like you don't find any, but the total number of draftable guards is fairly low. And a lot of them are playing with lean frames or non-ideal, non-pair frames. And I don't really consider that to be the issue with Dillinger. If you look at what he does in level two, I think he is somewhat lungy. He does that. There's some lunginess at the offensive line that would probably be his biggest weakness as a pass blocker as well. And trying to strike a little bit like Simpson, he can get a little out over his feet and be vulnerable to a push-pull move. It could happen on a run play also. Certainly could happen on a pass play where a big defensive tackle looks to get a piece of him and, you know, with one long arm, he looks to try and lunge into his body and the defensive tackle is able to throw him right past the play and throw him off his pins. Not a great athlete in terms of movement. He's okay. And that really begs the question of if this guy's the left guard and he's the best, he might be the best candidate to play left guard the Ravens have. Voorhees is a guy who we hope can move, but we haven't really seen it yet. Emory Jones is you know, much more slow-footed than Garrett Dillinger is. Dillinger is a guy who is not a special movement athlete, but Daniel Falele won't be moved from right guard. So whoever is going to jump in there and play left guard, the Ravens need some mobility at that position. And Dillinger might give them, Dillinger or Voorhees, one of the two, will give them the best opportunity to get that done. Ravens have a very good history of making the footwork work and making some average athletes like Kirsten Bozeman be able to learn how to pull. But he'll earn his money in the NFL as a pass blocker. He's been very good when healthy in the SEC, and it's something that I'll be excited to see if the Ravens can develop him. I think that if his anchor shows up from day one, I think he's a candidate to start. He's more physically developed than what you typically get in the seventh round. Almost always needs a year in the NFL weight room is a tagline you can throw on to almost any offensive line, often true of defensive linemen too, but really true of offensive linemen. Dillinger is one of the few guys who comes in with a body that really seems to be built for the NFL right now. And he has spent a little longer, not just 4 years at LSU, but he is 23. I love this pick both for value and need, and the big reason I love it is because I think it's also a prospective look at the possibility of not signing Tyler Linderbaum. If they can't come to terms on an extension, if they can't come to money that makes sense on a Linderbaum deal, then I think that he could be the 2026 Baltimore Ravens center. And if he was, this is all of a sudden a huge offensive line again with him fitting in at 325 with, whoever they've got, whether it's Jones or Voorhees playing at left guard and Fa'alele playing at right guard, the two tackles they have. I mean, it becomes an enormous offensive line, particularly in the middle where you really want that beef, and that'd be very exciting. So love the pick for value for Dellinger. The scale is small, the risk is small, the upside is terrific in terms of what could work out. And it's always possible he just won't make the cut. He won't be the player we hope he is at camp, but he is physically developed at a level that I'm fascinated by the fact the Ravens were able to get him at number 243. And the only thing I can think of is that there's still teams who have medical questions about his recovery from this tightrope surgery. So anyway, that's going to do it for the show. We had a tremendous amount of fun on draft night. If you joined us, thank you. If you didn't, do so next year. I think you'd really enjoy it. We got some new content coming up this week. We're going to look at the UDFAs, hopefully in the next day or two. After that, we'll be looking at unanswered questions. I'm going to try and do that show with Voss if he can find time out of his busy schedule. But if not, I'll do it with somebody else. And really appreciate the loyalty of the listens. We'll probably move into a slightly lower rate of shows per week. But the next major series I'll be doing is the expectations series, which usually starts right around the beginning of June. Might start a little bit early because Maureen and I are going on vacation in June, and we'll probably have about 2 weeks now, though, of slightly lighter show density or show frequency, I should say. But appreciate all of you for the listens. We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.